Make me pull rank, wingman.
He walked over to me and leaned against the counter, taking another bite of biscuit. Around the mouthful, Parker said,
Well,
I understand your concerns about Havel, but you know my history.
You think there's anyone on either ship who isn't feeling anxious right now? It's been 2 weeks since we've had contact with Earth.
I squared the baking sheet with the edge of the counter so I wouldn't have to watch him. I only mean that if you can trust me, surely you can trust him.
What's this? What happened to women are just as capable as men, and my anxiety isn't a problem, and rockets are safe enough even for ladies? Are you telling me you were wrong? Are you saying you aren't capable of more than baking and laundry?
No. God, he was such an asshole, throwing my words back at me like this. I'm just questioning why you're picking me over Raphael.
So you're questioning my judgment. That shouldn't surprise me.
See?
I pivoted on my heel to face him. We fight all the time. Why do you want me as your co-pilot? He leaned forward.
Because you don't take my shit. Because I've seen you in a crisis, and you are disciplined as hell. Because you are a damn good pilot. Because I'm the mission commander, and I said so. Now, do you have any more goddamn questions?
My entire body thrummed as if my pulse were an unbalanced engine. I don't know how, but I managed to lift my chin.
Yes. Were those compliments?
Parker laughed, and damn it, he had a good laugh, with his head thrown back and dimples. It cut off abruptly, and he straightened.
No. Those were critical assessments.
He held up the remnant of the biscuit.
This is a compliment. Damn good biscuits.
Tossing the last piece into his mouth, he walked back to the whiteboard as if he'd said nothing at all. Before I had a chance for the shock to run through my system, De Beer and Heidi walked into the kitchen from the garden module. I shook my head to clear it and opened a drawer to grab a spatula, except it was the towel drawer. Why would anyone keep their kitchen towels next to the stove? Since I had it open, I grabbed one to toss into a bowl for serving the biscuits. Behind me, other crew members entered the room for the meeting. Snippets of conversation floated through the room.
Rossini's best opera.
And then, halfway through the book, the main character dies.
I think the gin might be ready.
Gin? I volunteer as
I looked over my shoulder and spotted Cam talking with Leonard.
You cut your hair.
Stupid, I know, but she had cropped the long, dark hair that had waved down to the middle of her back into a military buzz cut, and at first all I could see was that. She blushed and ran a hand over the dark velvet at the side of her head. Without the abundance of hair, her eyes seemed huge.
I just got tired of fighting with it in zero-G.
Maybe I should think about it, although I didn't think Nathaniel would like it much. My gut twisted a little at that. Everything, even small things, reminded me that we had no idea what was happening on Earth. There weren't enough biscuits in the universe. Opening the random drawer where they kept cooking utensils, I pulled out a spatula and began transferring the biscuits to the bowl. By the time I finished, everyone had arrived and was in various stages of settling for the Monday meeting. Scents of coffee and biscuits made the room seem almost like home. I settled next to Leonard, who grinned as he reached for a biscuit. De Beer had been moving toward the bowl but stopped, the corners of his mouth turned down. He sat next to Heidi with only a cup of coffee. His loss.
All right, people.
Parker tapped the board.
You'll notice that we're splitting the crews back to their original formation with a couple of adjustments. York is going to pick up co-pilot duties on the Niña, and over here, Fogeli will train with Shamoon to brush up on medical skills. Shamoon will still make house calls if there is anything serious, but hopefully this will cut down on the number of busy bee trips.
Graham raised his hand. Parker gestured with his chin.
Go ahead.
I'm only wondering, if the goal is to reduce the number of busy bee trips, why are we splitting the crews again? Would it not make more sense for you all to stay here, especially given the circumstances?
The goal is to get us all safely to Mars and back to Earth.
Parker tapped the board.
Before we lost contact, Mission Control wanted the Niña operational and staffed again, so that's what we're going to do.
De Beer shifted in his seat, but Dawn touched his knee before raising her hand. She didn't wait for Parker to call on her, though.
That's not the way Mission Control was going to staff us. De Beer was supposed to move over to the Niña and join the Mars landing party.
Ah, that was what this was about, then. A cold tremor seized the back of my neck. Once again, I was taking someone else's spot, and De Beer didn't have any reason to back down. Binkowski stepped forward with a downward slash of his palm.
At this point, Mission Control is not in full possession of the facts, so this is the staffing.
Right.
Parker's shark smile came out, and he turned it on De Beer.
We're doing a pilot NavComp breakout after this to talk about the course correction that's coming up. De Beer! I want you taking notes on that, now that I know how good your lettering is.
I kicked up the spindle toward the bridge of the Niña, hauling a baggie with a piece of chess pie. As the comm mod came up, I grabbed the rail and used the momentum to swing through the door. Florence floated in her sleeping bag, which she'd moved into the mod just in case there was a peep from Earth. Which there hadn't been for 3 weeks and one day. She had her needlepoint out, and it was far enough along now that you could recognize Orion in the starfield. Florence tucked the needle into a corner.
To what do I owe the pleasure?
I brought you some pie. I sent the baggie spinning across the mod to her. Florence snatched it out of the air with a grin.
You are my favorite person.
I snorted.
Right now, she winked. Keep plying me with your pie.
Ply pie.
I sigh.
She opened the baggie and inhaled deeply.
Seriously, though, consider me bribed. What do you need?
Nothing. I stopped as she gave me the look. Caught me. Did you run my burn plan through the mechanical computer?
Every time. As per protocol. You know it's never caught you out even once.
She narrowed her gaze at me.
Why?
I just... Reassurance? I'm working without all the numbers that I'd have if Earth were...
It's fine, Elma. No errors.
I swallowed. Thanks. Anything I can do for you? I mean, you're sort of trapped in here. She shrugged as if the schedule adjustment to keep the comm mods on both ships staffed at all times were no big deal.
Eh, at least it means I don't have to do laundry anymore. And Barker has me rotating with Hafael and Leonard.
All the same. Need anything? Florence patted the intercom next to her.
I'll call if I do. And I'll call the moment we hear from them.
The longer the silence went, the more worried we all got. But while the undercurrent of fear grew, so did our kindness. In much the same way people rallied together after the meteor. Please, God, please let it not be another meteor. Well, I better get up to the bridge. Just wanted to drop that off on my way.
Much appreciated.
She clipped the baggie to the wall.
It'll be my treat after I finish this bit.
With a wave, I kicked out of the comm mod and grabbed a handrail to propel myself up to the bridge. I wanted to be there before Parker so he couldn't complain about me being late. As I passed through the hatch of the CEM, I hesitated, gnawing on the inside of my lip. Sitting in the co-pilot's chair on the bridge shouldn't be a big deal. It was only one seat over from the NavComp station. And yet it made me keenly aware of Tarazis's absence. I gripped the back of his chair. What would he say about all of this? And this installment, our intrepid adventurers. Behind me, Parker sighed. I froze, blushing because he'd caught me being silly. He cleared his throat.
Our intrepid adventurers begin their approach to Mars. He was a good man.
Yeah. Parker put a hand on my shoulder.
You'll do fine, York.
God damn it if my eyes didn't fill with tears. I wiped them off on the back of my sleeve before they could blind me. Well, I don't have his radio voice. Pulling myself around the seat, I settled into it. 1 meter to the left of where I usually sat, and it was an entirely different world. You look over the burn plan? Of course he had. It was insulting to ask, but I had to fill the silence with something. Parker slid into his own chair, buckling in.
Looks good. It's just a little off the original flight plan.
Which was to be expected, and yet... I wasn't used to being worried about my math. Rafael had reconfigured the CM a little to put my NavComp tools within reach of the co-pilot chair, including plugging a gimbal arm for my sextant into a whiff socket so I could keep it out, but not have to hold it. It was more for comfort than anything else, because Heidi and I had calculated the burn already, and Florence and Dawn had fed that information into the mechanical computers on the Santa Maria, which would do an automatic burn. But what if I was starting from an erroneous data point? It could be like the time that I'd misidentified Al-Qaeda in the sim and sent us all to our deaths. Yes. Yes, I know that there were safeguards. but I hate computing without the benefit of all the information I'm used to.
Okay. Set to roll, 198.6, pitch, 130.7, and yaw, 340.
Parker began flipping switches on the control panel, calling out his settings as he did.
198.6, 130.7, 340.
As co-pilot, my job was simply to make certain that everything was set correctly. Nothing more right now. But I watched him set up for the burn like a hawk. The timer ticked us closer to the mark for the burn. Wetting my lips, I pulled the mic to me.
Prepare for burn? 10, 9, 8.
Everyone would already be in lockdown.
7, 6, 5.
Next to me, Parker held the ship's joystick lightly in his hand.
4, 3, 2, 1.
He fired the engines. The seat slammed forward to meet us, and outside the viewport, flame blossomed from the back of the Pinta as they started their burn. I dragged in air past the weight sitting on my chest. If I needed reminding that the spinning section of the Niña only had Mars gravity, this was it. 10 seconds. An eternity. They are much the same thing sometimes. 10 seconds, and everything had changed. We had begun the slowdown for Mars. 30.
First Mars Expedition Mission Log, Commander Stetson Parker. July 19th, 1963, 1:05 a.m. Niña and Pinta teams have completed preparations for insertion into Mars orbit. Day 53 of communication blackout with IAC.
I thought it was a dream at first. I was floating in the dark of crew quarters when Florence very calmly said,
Parker, come to the comm mod. Repeat. Parker to comm mod.
She was so calm that I almost drifted back to sleep. There were no alarm bells, no klaxons. It wasn't an emergency, and she had sounded so gentle. Cam whispered, Is it mission control? That ratcheted me to full alertness. I twisted in my sleeping bag to peer out of my cubby. Parker floated in the middle of crew quarters, pulling a flight suit on over his underwear.
Don't know yet. Stay here.
I had been undoing the straps that kept my sleeping bag closed, but stopped as I woke up a little more. Right. I didn't need everyone crowding in there. Not that I'd be able to sleep, wondering what was going on. It could simply be a call from the Pinta. Though few calls in the middle of the night were innocuous. Still zipping up, Parker kicked off and drifted over to me.
York.
He whispered, with me. And that woke me the rest of the way up. As his co-pilot, he'd need me in case whatever this was required moving the ship or God knows what. I pushed the neck of the bag the rest of the way open and slipped out. Grabbing my flight suit, I nodded, right behind you. He didn't wait and spun in the air to aim toward the hatch into the spindle. As I wriggled into my suit, the rest of the crew poked their heads out of their cubbies like gophers. Leonard's teeth flashed in the dim light.
Do you know what's going on?
I know as much as you. I zipped my suit shut, twisting to head to the hatch. Parker will give a sit rep as soon as he has it. Sit rep. Situation report. So much tension packed into those syllables. I flew down the spindle to the comm mod as Parker hooked around the corner and vanished into its hatch. As I got closer, the constant hum of the Niña's fan seemed to part and let the clatter of the teletype through like angels singing hosannas.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Malech Ahalom Hagomer Lahayavim Tovat Shek Molani Kol Tov.
The prayer of thanks slipped out, even though I still had a list of worries as long as my arm. As I caught the edge of the hatch and swung into the comm mod, Florence's face gave me a lot of the answers I needed, or raised more questions, or both. She was smiling, but her eyes were red as if she'd been crying.
Yes, it's mission control. Yes, Nathaniel is on the team sending the message.
Thank God. I clutched my chest as if I were a damsel in a melodrama. But honestly, I felt as if someone had just untied me from the railroad tracks. I still didn't know why the Earth had been out of contact for almost 2 months, but my husband was alive and well. I swallowed the tears of relief and tried to focus on my job.
What happened?
Protesters.
Parker hunched over the teletype, reading the pages as they fed out of it.
The Earthfirsters knocked out the satellites.
My God.
Florence pushed off the desk to get closer to the teletype.
How the hell?
Apparently that conspiracy theory about someone in the IAC being a member of Earthfirst? Not so crackpot. Someone in the computer department sent up bad code that deorbited both satellites.
Jesus.
He ran a hand over his head, resting it on the bald spot. They took out the power grid in Kansas, too.
Wait. Who was it?
I also pulled myself closer to the teletype, which continued to rattle as if it were a small child that had been waiting all day for Daddy to get home. He scrolled down the page. Curtis Fry, Jennifer Lynn, and Tyler Richter?
I don't know them.
New hires, apparently.
Parker stopped moving.
The pages scrolled up through his limp fingers. He took a breath and turned an utterly impersonal mask to Florence. Let the crew know that we've reestablished contact with Earth. I doubt any of them went back to sleep. York, help facilitate the distribution of personal mail and prepare updated duty rosters. I'll review those before we hand them out. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Parker turned a somersault and kicked off to swim smoothly out the hatch of the comm mod. Here's the thing. I know what it looks like when Parker gets bad news. I remember from the days when he had trouble with his leg going numb, how he goes cold and concentrates on business. I know the faint green tinge that colors his cheeks. As Florence grabbed the edge of the desk and pulled herself closer to the teletype, my mind unfolded the facts into a rigid equation. Personal mail was coming through. The Kansas power grid went down. His wife was in an iron lung. I was halfway to the hatch before I'd thought about it. It would kill him to have anyone offer sympathy, so why did I follow him? I don't know. Or, no, I do. There are some things you don't let anyone, not even your worst enemy, go through alone. And I was his co-pilot. The spindle was empty. He had tucked into some nook while I was still sorting things out. Some nook. I stopped outside the hatch to the busy bee. Soundproof. Through the portal, the interior was lit only by the sunlight reflected from the Pinta. Parker floated in the middle in a silent ball. I tried to undog the hatch as noisily as possible so he'd have plenty of warning, but when I pulled it open, the sound came out. He couldn't have heard anything. I said that I knew what it looked like when Parker received bad news. No, I knew what his public face looked like. This. Each sob shook his entire body and bounced off the walls of the busy bee in ragged waves. He floated in the middle of the aisle, wrapped into a tiny ball as if he could contain his own grief. For a moment I hesitated because he didn't know I was there and would not thank me. But who else was I supposed to get? Cam, maybe? Minkowski, if we were still on the Pinta. It didn't matter. I was here and I had made the choice to follow. Parker? He jerked, lifting his head. Even with his back to me, I could see his effort to pull the mask into place. His breath tore into coughs and ragged pants. Parker swiped his arm across his eyes, spinning globules of water across the cabin.
Does Mission Control need me?
I shook my head, then realized he still couldn't see. No. Biting my lip, I pushed closer until I floated just behind him. I almost asked him directly, but I still didn't have permission to talk about his wife. The power grid. I'm so sorry. He broke. That thin hull of control shattered on reentry, and he disintegrated into racking sobs. I wrapped my arms around him as if I could help him stay together, or maybe just find the pieces afterward. Parker hung in my embrace. One hand latched onto my forearm and dug in as if he were trying to pull himself back. We rotated in that dark space as his grief spun out around us.
I'm sorry.
Parker's voice was rough and thick. He rubbed his sleeve across his eyes.
Jesus Christ, I'm...
His voice broke again, and for a moment his chest jerked with silent weeping. He coughed and cleared his throat.
Shit. Sorry.
What can I do?
Cover for me.
He stretched out a little from the tight ball he'd been in, and I let him go.
I'm going to be a mess for a while.
Sure. I let momentum create some space between us. Do you want me to get anyone else?
Fuck no, don't tell a goddamn soul.
Okay. I bit my lip, aware that I'd left Florence with all the papers pouring out of the teletype. Florence might have told people. Parker drifted slowly through the busy bee, his face as red and swollen as if he'd been stung by wasps. He shook his head.
There's no way she could know. There's a message from Mimi with all the other personal messages, but you aren't the only one with a private cipher, just the one who got caught.
Oh.
Bet you got a lot to say about that.
Teach me how to not get caught? He laughed until it turned into weeping again. He wiped his face.
I knew they'd pull something like this, that they wouldn't want me to be upset if she died and they'd fake letters from her. So there was a code. It went into everything, even the shortest of messages. Wasn't there.
Maybe they edited—
Don't! He straightened and jabbed a finger at me. Don't you fucking dare give me false hope, York! She couldn't survive outside the iron lung for more than an hour, two at the most. Our backup generator would last for 24 hours. A week and a half without power? She would have made damn sure her code was in the message after that. Mimi is—
His face crumpled as his mouth snapped shut to keep back a moan. I pulled closer, but he shook his head, so I stopped. I'll go cover. He nodded.
Be there as soon as I can.
Take your time. He gave a half laugh and waved me away. It felt wrong to leave him alone, which was a new sensation. Usually I wanted to get away from him as fast as I could. Putting a hand on one of the chairs in the busy bee, I reoriented myself to face the hatch. With a push of my fingertips, I floated up to that end of the cabin.
York.
The humming fans almost masked his voice. Yeah? I used the hatch edge to turn and face him.
Tonight, will you help me recite the Kaddish for her? I don't know it, and—
Parker pressed the heels of both hands against his eyes and ground his teeth together. Yes, of course. He nodded, jaw still tight. I slipped out and let the door of the busy bee mask the rest. 31.
Two satellites revive in space. Kansas City, Kansas, July 19th, 1963. Two United Nations communication satellites, which had been presumed dead following terrorist acts by Earth First in May, were restored through a Herculean effort by the International Aerospace Coalition. These satellites, which have provided easy telephonic communication on Earth, were also part of the network that allowed communication with the first Mars expedition. The astronauts and astronets have been isolated from the rest of humankind as their ships hurtled through fathomless space. The entire world is thrilled to learn that their mission has continued and that they were preparing to enter Mars orbit. In a teletype interview, Mission Commander Stetson Parker said, "We were entrusted by the people of Earth to carry out this mission, and I look forward to showing them the grand sight of our sister planet."
The letter from Nathaniel burned a hole in the pocket of my flight suit, but I was resolutely not reading it. Parker hadn't emerged yet from the busy bee, and we had work to do. I stood at the front of the kitchen next to the whiteboard, where Parker should be. Thank God for his clipboard, which hid how badly my hands were shaking. I have to say, my anxiety is incredibly stupid. It shows now, when I was faced with a room of four whole people I knew, to decide that my throat should close. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. I cleared my throat, or tried to. Good thing I had experience talking around a lump. This is the duty roster that Mission Control sent up, but Parker is reviewing it before we lock anything in. Not that I really thought his review time would set him to rights. Until we're ready to send the lander down, there are no changes from what we rehearsed back on Luneta, so our plans this week will start with reviewing material. Parker slid down the ladder into the kitchen.
Thanks for getting us started, York.
He had bathed and carried the scent of aftershave into the room.
Just got off the line with Binkowski, and I have some updates.
I held out his clipboard. He took it with a nod, but didn't meet my gaze. He held the board in one hand, letting it hang at his side in a seemingly casual pose, but his knuckles stood out white against his skin. I took a step to retreat to the safety of the kitchen table, but Parker stopped me.
Stay put.
Then he did that thing where he rolls his neck to crack it before starting work.
All right, people. You have a lot of questions, and I told Gray and York to hold off until I could talk to Mission Control directly. There's information they couldn't say in the clear, and truly, they would probably rather that I not tell you either, but fuck 'em. Here's the set rep.
My teammates came to full attention. Leonard had his elbows on the table with his hands steepled in front of his face. Raphael lifted his head. Florence cocktails to the side, eyes narrowing, and Cam sat forward, uncrossing her legs.
The Earthfirsters weren't working alone. They had a collaborator inside the IAC computer department. They also made a strike at the Kansas spaceport and knocked out the power grid, using arms from the former Soviet Union. We're still not sure if Russia was an active participant, but it seems possible.
Cam raised her hand. What about the Artemis base and Luneta? Are they okay? Parker nodded.
The Brazilian and European spaceports could handle the traffic, but all the communications were running through Kansas and up to the satellites. The long and short of it is that Mission Control can talk to us, but they can't see us. When we do the Mars orbit insertion, we're going to be relying entirely on our navcomps.
On me? On Heidi? Were they getting the same lecture over on the Pinta?
The same might be true for the trip home, because building new satellites is not fast, and to be blunt, we aren't a funding priority to Earth right now.
Parker turned the clipboard over in his hands.
This means that our navcomps have just become our most important crew members.
Hello, anxiety. My mouth flooded with saliva in the old familiar precursor to vomiting. 3.14159. I swallowed hard and breathed in slowly through my nose.
Benkoski and I have decided that the next decision is one that you should all share in, so this is the rare time where I will ask for a vote. Getting home safely is significantly more probable if we slingshot around Mars and don't land.
Hell no.
Raphael slashed the air with his hand.
Not after everything. You can throw me out the airlock, but I'm going down.
Yeah.
Leonard nodded.
You think they'd let me come back and try again? No way.
That's true.
Parker turned to the board and made 2 tick marks, as if we had so many people that they needed to be counted. Or maybe he just needed to turn his back to the room for a minute.
What do our ladies say?
I'm with Leonard for the same reasons.
Florence shrugged.
Didn't come all this way just to turn around and go home.
Same, Cam laughed.
I can't believe you guys thought that anyone would want to go home.
York. He held up a finger. Wait, before you answer, you should know that, given the new constraints, you and Vogele won't get to land.
Florence snorted.
Hold on. What was the point of me learning how to use that damn mechanical contraption if it wasn't to be a backup for York?
That aspect is not up for a vote.
It's okay. It's the way I went to the moon the first time, just circled the darn thing. I'd promised Nathaniel that I would come home. And if this is what it took to get us back, then so be it. Mars or bust. Parker appeared to stare at the 5 tick marks on the board for a moment. Because I was standing next to the board, I had a view of his face that none of the rest were privy to, and his eyes were clamped shut. He did not draw a 6th mark for himself, but let out a very slow breath.
Well, that was simple.
If he couldn't see his face, he would have sounded breezy and confident. When Parker opened his eyes, he swiped away some of the roster I'd written on the board.
So, looking at the dirty roster, some things are going to change. York is going to need time to make sure our flight plan is 100% accurate, so I'll be shifting her other duties to the rest of us.
Terrific. I studied the scuff marks on the kitchen floor so I wouldn't have to see the resentment creep back into their eyes. Raphael shifted in his chair.
I can... You want me to move over to co-pilot?
Parker turned, lips pursed, and studied Raphael.
Let's talk about that after the meeting. For the moment, I need you and Stewman to concentrate on making sure the landers are in order.
I tucked my hands behind my back so no one would see them shaking. I don't mind doing other work. I'll need a break from calculations.
Then take a goddamn break. Or do you not know how to do that?
He was mourning. Or at least I could pretend that the sharp bite in his voice was part of an effort to mask grief. It wasn't about me. That thought made me lift my head and turn to face Parker. It had never been about me. It was like the ball of anxiety in my stomach sublimated into space, going from a solid knot to vapor. It escaped in a sort of laugh. I think the laugh startled him as much as it did me. Let him think it was me discovering a sense of humor. I lifted my chin. I take a break by cooking, so keep me on the goddamn kitchen roster, or so help me, I will bake pies and give you none.
Florence laughed.
She's got you, Parker. She's got you good.
Well, he cracked his neck and faced the board again, this time with a grin.
So long as you're admitting that your place is in the kitchen.
Yep. I slapped the whiteboard, standing right next to you.
Dear Ilma, I love you. Thank God you're safe. No, I haven't been sleeping enough. None of us have. But Thomas has been a trooper. And yes, he's kept me fed. I don't know what I would have done without him. More later when the official communications are caught up. For now, know that I'm well. I love you. I'm proud of you. I'll say it again. I love you. Nathaniel.
Parker was already sitting on the weight bench when I got to the gym. It wasn't used much late at night, and while the busy bee was soundproof, gravity seemed important for this. He looked up when I came in and gave a little wave.
Thanks for covering.
My job. I sat down on the floor in front of him. What'd you and Rafael decide?
He'll take the lander down to Mars with Flannery. I should not be flying. And getting the Niña into orbit just involves following your directions.
No pressure or anything?
Please.
He snorted, picking at a loose thread on his flight suit.
I kept trying to get you to crack back at the beginning. You're unflappable. No sense of humor, but you're iron.
I gaped a little at him.
Me, unflappable.
You know, I was throwing up almost every day. Parker's head came up sharply.
You're shitting me.
Why the hell did you think I was on Milltown?
I figured it was some woman thing.
Parker shrugged and rubbed the back of his neck.
Look, I'm sorry.
Please notice my restraint. I didn't ask him if he was sorry because of the woman thing or because he had made me throw up. At the moment, it really didn't matter. Apology confirmed. Parker's face twisted and he bent at the waist, covering his mouth with his hands. I scooted forward as a series of sobs shook him. Even with his hands pressed over his mouth, you could hear the sides of his throat ripping open. Rising onto my knees, I pulled him into my arms. Parker let his head rest on my shoulder. It didn't last long. He shook his head, pulling back.
Sorry. Shit.
Parker pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and blew his nose with wet, gross vigor.
I can't tell what's going to set me off.
Nodding, I settled back on my heels. It's awful. It'll catch you by surprise. The worst are the happy moments. He swallowed, clenching his jaw and stared over to his left, as if the weight rack were the most important thing on the ship, after the meteor, when my parents, most of my family, died. I kept doing exactly that, forgetting they were dead. I still do sometimes. And the memory smacks me in the face that I can't share something with Mama, or that Daddy will never know that I was an astronaut, that I am an astronaut. How old are your sons now?
16. In her last letter, Mimi said that they were already arguing about who was going to pick me up when we got home.
His face spasmed again, and he shut his eyes, grimacing like he could squeeze all that pain back inside. 16. He was going to miss their graduation. They'd be off at college by the time we got back, but reminding him of that seemed cruel. A couple of short breaths later, his eyes opened again.
Even in the lung, you know. She was such a good mom.
That seemed like my best opening to actually talk about her. Besides the Kaddish, we do something called sitting Shiva. It's a mourning period, and it starts with telling stories about the one we lost.
Kind of like awake.
I guess. Parker straightened a little, running a hand over his hair.
Mimi was a really private person.
Is that why you never talk about her?
Pretty much.
He stretched his hands out and his wedding ring caught the light. I'd never seen him wear it before. The way we deal with grief is weird.
After the polio, she hated feeling like a burden. Hated it. Hated having people stare at her. But she was trapped. And wicked smart. I wouldn't have gotten into the space program if she hadn't been there helping me study. But then, I was the first man in space, and suddenly we had reporters everywhere.
I winced, remembering my transition to being the lady astronaut. They're like leeches.
And she would have been the human interest story of the century.
He held up his hand.
I stopped wearing my ring.
I bribed people, took every high-paying job I could so I could set her up with private care, moved her out of the house, everything I could do to keep her out of the spotlight.
The ship's fans whispered around us as we sat opposite each other. What kind of music did she like?
Ragtime.
The corner of his mouth turned up in a half-smile.
She had a player piano and collected rolls of music. Had one that was signed by Scott Joplin, even.
Golly.
She composed for them, too. Couldn't play anymore on account of the polio. But she figured out how I could rig it so she could punch sheets of music. Told you she was wicked smart.
She sounds spectacular. I was curious, so curious to know how he rationalized his affairs when he clearly loved her. None of my business, but oh, I wanted to know. I'd love to hear some of her music.
When we get back to Earth.
He almost lost it again. I used the only line I could think of to reel him back in. Language. Ready to learn some Aramaic?
Not Hebrew.
Not for this. He should be standing to do this, but I wasn't going to force my entire culture on him. Yit gadal v'yit kadesh shme rabah ba'alma divra. Parker cocked his head.
Yigtadel yikadesh? That's not right, is it?
It wasn't, but it was closer than most Jews on their first attempt. I slowed down. Yit gadal v'yit kadesh.
Yit gadal v'yit kadesh.
That attempt was greenlit, and I hated him a little for picking it up so quickly. Glorified and sanctified be God's great name. He nodded as if he already knew the meaning. Being Parker, he probably did.
She said it every year on the anniversary of the meteor.
A lot of us do. I did. Every year. For my mother and my father and my aunts and cousins and the hundreds of thousands of people who died. Yit kadal v'yit kadash shme rabah ba'alma d'ivra. He rubbed his eyes with the back of his hand.
Don't think this gets you out of teaching me Yiddish.
We'll do that while everyone else is on Mars. He nodded, and then Stetson Parker, widower of Miriam Parker, née Kaplan, began the Kaddish again. It took us a long while to get through it. I think it helped. September 3rd, 1963. Dear Nathaniel, unless I really botch things, by this time tomorrow we'll be in orbit around Mars. I'm not actually worried about the calculations, because Heidi and I have triple-checked each other, and Florence and Dawn have run everything through the mechanical computers. Well, Dawn did. Florence is jammed twice when she was feeding the punch cards in, and Tafael is still trying to get the feeder clear. But I guess that's why I'm here, and why Mission Control won't let me go to the surface. Nor Heidi. Neither of us take it personally, although I'll admit that it is hard to be this close. The logic of it makes sense, though. I wish you could see Mars. Leonard has had the big telescope aimed at it for the past month. He's got his eye on a couple of potential landing spots, but won't make that determination until we've been in orbit for a while. You know that. I don't know why I keep telling you things that you know, except maybe that I miss you. Mars is beautiful, in very different ways from Earth. We always call it the Red Planet, but it's more of a soft salmon, with smoky grays and the occasional patch of umber. I'm fairly certain that when we send pictures back, it will become the new spring fashion palette. Please tell Thomas that I send my love, and that I'm very proud of the help he's giving you. All my love, Elma. Mars filled the viewport. Reds and ochres and umbers and a patch of white ice at the pole. And I could pay attention to none of it. Not until we were in orbit. Sitting in the pilot's seat, Parker's hands were steady on the controls. Thank God. I think he still crumpled. But he was keeping it together in public. Quieter than usual for the past month. Less likely to make verbal jabs. But he was steady at the helm. Parker flipped the ship-wide mic on.
Stand by for the burn.
From the engineering mod, Rafael said,
Your intrepid adventurers await.
Confirmed intrepid.
Parker switched off the mic and his voice was hoarse.
Will you do the count?
Roger. Maybe he wasn't as steady as I thought. I turned on my mic, keeping my eye on the clock and our altitude. On my mark. 10, 9, 8,
7. These numbers only made my tension grow. 6. 5. 4.
Starting engines.
3. 2. 1. Mark. The great engines of the Niña fired, slamming me into my harness. The side of the viewport lit up as the Pinta and the Santa Maria mirrored us. As suddenly as it came, the thrust vanished. Parker took his hands off the controls and let out a long breath. That was it for a display of nerves.
Burn status report. Delta TIG 0, burn time 557, shaft value on the angles VGX minus 0.1, VGY minus 0.1, VGZ plus 0.1. No trim, minus 6.8 on Delta VC, LOX 39.0, plus 50 on balance.
Confirmed. I flipped off my mic and pulled my papers closer. For the record, that was a perfect burn.
And you turned your mic off for that.
Parker leaned forward in his seat and pointed out the viewport.
That's the likely landing approach, isn't it?
Below us, the red hills rolled underneath the window. We had a down again. Leonard had brought pictures of it to the meeting, but it was like the difference between a radio program and a live performance. The textures and sharp definition of the setting sun made the edges pop with ruddy gold. Parker sat back in his seat, grinning for the first time in days.
Altitude, 204 kilometers. I am good.
I thought you were just following my numbers.
With precision.
I snorted and kept working with the data coming in. We were using the early lander and the orbital satellites that IAC had sent ahead of us to get positional readings. Parker's burn might have been perfect, but until we had confirmed orbit, my numbers were still suspect. My pencil flew over the paper, sketching out our orbit as Mars turned below us. It looked good. I bit my lip and did it again. Same result. I circled it. The preliminary tracking data for the first few minutes shows us in a 61.6 by 169.5 orbit. We're stable. Parker pulled the microphone closer and from somewhere pulled out an announcer voice that would have made Terrazas proud.
Bold adventurers! The lady astronaut has just pronounced a stable orbit. Welcome to Mars.
32.
Survey finds public backs Mars landing. With the first Mars expedition scheduled to land tomorrow, the American people now favor landing a man on Mars by 51% to 41%, according to a new poll by Lewis Harris, published yesterday in the Kansas City Post. That opinion has changed dramatically in the past year, largely as a backlash against the Earth First movement.
Maybe we'd picked up the habit from the Pinta crew. Or maybe it was just because the best table was in the kitchen, but for whatever reason, Rafael, Leonard, and I had started doing our work there. It was probably the table, because Leonard had a series of photos spread out at one end of the table and was working on a map of the landing site. Rafael squinted at the Mars Lander's manual with his fingers pressed to one temple. My eyes were starting to cross from staring at numbers all day. Shutting my binder, I stretched. Cake or pie?
Pie.
Leonard raised his hand. Thwacking him with a pencil, Rafael said, Cake. So I get to make whatever I want. Noted. I slid my legs around the end of the bench and stood. Truly, cakes were harder with the materials on hand, but I had a hankering for Mama's pound cake, although I wasn't sure how I was going to fake sour cream. Rafael rested his head on the binder with a thump.
I should take a break, too. That looks like a nap.
Leonard pretended to consult an imaginary clipboard.
Doesn't appear to be on today's agenda.
Leave him alone. Those landers have a console that is stubbornly counterintuitive at first. It had been a pain learning to use the console for the moon, but after that the thing was dead simple. Leaving my binder of calculations, I wandered over to the kitchen. Could you sour powdered milk with lemon juice? Maybe I should do pie after all. Rafael grunted behind me.
You're not kidding.
You should ask Parker if you can go over to the Santa Maria and pull the lander out of mothballs. On the other hand, a simple chocolate cake might be nice. I could add some cinnamon to it. It's easier to remember the shutdown sequence when you're looking at it.
You say that as if you have personal experience.
Grabbing a bowl out of the cabinet, I glanced over my shoulder at Rafael. It's the same console as what I was flying on the moon.
His jaw dropped. Puta que pariu. I knew that. I had just... Why the hell am I taking it down?
I set the bowl on the counter and turned to face him fully. It's not the same. I wasn't flying in atmosphere.
Yeah, but you still had more flight time on it than I had on the simulator.
Being a pilot, the urge to agree was very strong. I did have more flight time. I wanted to go down to Mars so badly I could taste it. But I also knew why I wasn't. I gestured at my binder on the table. Open it. Rafael rolled his eyes.
Come on, Ilma.
I'm serious. Can you do any of those equations? This, right here. This was what Helen had done when she gave up her spot to me. Not that the causes were the same. But the fact of bowing to a world that you couldn't change. She wasn't happy about it, and I won't pretend that I was either, but these are the realities. I'm staying here and doing math, but first, pie. Leonard smiled.
I do like pie.
Me too. 3.14159265. I winked at him, but I was going to make a pie. Meanwhile, oh pilot, have you thought about what you're going to call the lander? Rafael looked down, smoothing the pages with one hand.
The Tarazis.
Do you remember where you were when mankind landed on Mars? I was on the bridge of the Niña, sitting in the co-pilot's seat with my pencil and paper ready to plot. Parker sat in the seat next to me with nothing to do. We stared out the viewport and listened to the radio channels as the Tarazis entered the atmosphere of Mars. The rest of our crew was aboard. They would go first, and then, assuming all went well, the crew of the Pinta would descend in 2 weeks. Leonard's voice came through clear and steady.
Our radar checks indicate 15.24 kilometers paramars. Our visual altitude checks are steadying out at about 16.15 kilometers.
I added that to the worksheet for the Tarazis' descent. Confirmed? I recommend you yaw 10 right, then your go for powered descent. Over?
Confirmed go for powered descent.
They had 5 minutes before they initiated the descent. Until that point, they were just in a lower orbit than we were. Beside me, Parker flexed his hands on his knees as if he wanted to reach for the controls himself. Rafael's voice came faintly through Leonard's microphone.
Stabilization and control circuit breakers. Deca gimbal AC closed. Command override off. Gimbal enable. Rate scale 25.
Aside from the red planet filling the viewport, it was almost like being in a sim. On my mark, 3:30 till ignition.
Confirmed.
I watched the clock and their position. Mark. 3:30 till ignition.
Confirmed. Thrust translation for jets. Balance couple on. TC throttle minimum. Throttle auto CDR. Propellant button reset. Prop button.
Leonard's voice was cool as he read off the checklist for Rafael.
All right. Abort, abort stage reset. At control, three of them to mode control. AGS is reading 400 plus one.
In my head, I could see the cockpit of the Tarazis. They were flying with their engine forward so they could use it to slow down and had their windows pointing planetward in order to confirm their trajectory. They'd do a 180-degree yaw so they could point their radar at the surface. From there on, it would be all up to Rafael's flying. I kept my pencil out anyway. When Rafael said,
"Ignition,"
Parker lifted both hands, fingers crossed. I watched them on our radar. Their rate of descent looks good. Parker muttered,
God, I don't know how Mimi stood it.
My gaze stayed fixed on the radar, but with my free hand, I reached over and gave his arm a quick squeeze. She knew who she was marrying.
Huh.
Like a radio play without narration, Leonard said,
Throttle down. 6+25. Throttle down.
I bit my lip. They were going to reduce thrust 6:25 into the burn, which made sense. I just wanted something to do. It was the longest 6:25 of my life.
Throttling down. 1,500-meter altitude. 30.5 meters per second. Attitude control is good.
Finally, numbers I could do something with again.
It was simple enough that I could do it in my head, but I plugged them into the worksheet for safety. Your go for landing, over?
Confirmed. 914 at 21.3.
I nodded, even though he couldn't see me. Confirmed. Go for landing. 914 meters.
610 meters. 610 meters.
Parker leaned forward as if he could see them outside the viewport. The reds and ochres scrolled underneath us. Theoretically, the Terrazas was directly below. As thin as Mars's atmosphere was, the streak of their entry didn't light up as much as it would have on Earth.
35 degrees. 35 degrees. 229 meters. Coming down at 7 meters per second.
Leonard could be announcing stocks rather than landing on a planet.
183 meters down at 5.8.
I tracked them on my sheet, not because there was anything I could do, but just so I had something to do with my hands. I traced the arc of their descent the way I used to track Parker going into orbit.
107 meters down at 1.2. We've got a shadow.
It would be different landing in an atmosphere, even a thin one, but I knew that shadow. They were nearly down.
30.5 meters, 1.1 down, 2.7 forward.
Cam and Florence must be staring out the windows from the back of the lander.
12.2 meters down, 0.76. Picking up some dust.
I held my breath, and I'm pretty sure Parker did too. In fact, the entire ship seemed to go silent, as if the fans had stopped blowing while we waited.
Contact flight.
For the first time in the last 10 minutes, we heard Rafael speak as calm as anything.
Shut down. Engine stop.
Parker let out a whoop as if he'd been holding it in since Earth. I threw my papers into the air and they floated around us in a snow globe of calculations. Through the speakers, I could just barely hear Florence in the background laughing with glee. Rafael's calm must have been masking an ear-splitting grin.
Niña, this is Bradbury Base. The Terrazas has landed.
At the sound of their new call sign, my eyes pricked with tears. God, they had really made it. Parker grabbed the mic.
Glad to hear it, Bradbury. Congratulations on a beautiful landing.
Bradbury Pinta.
Behind Binkowski's voice, I could hear the crew of the Pinta cheering.
We're all. Congratulations. Can't wait to join you.
Thanks. The view is something. It looks all red from up in the air, but some of the rocks outside look bluish.
Rafael laughed.
Leonard just rolled his eyes at my science. We'd better get busy, or he'll start the EVA without us.
Get to it, and take pictures.
Parker turned the mic off and looked over at me, grinning. Papers spun between us still. He snatched one out of the air, looking at the calculations that covered it.
You done good, York.
It's my job. Parker's grin softened into something. I don't know. Something almost fond.
I'm sorry you don't get to go down.
I shrugged, looking out the window as Mars turned below me. I wanted Nathaniel to see it. And Rachel and Thomas and Herschel and Helen and everyone. Not this time. But it won't be my only chance. When I got back to Earth, I was going to use everything in my power to get the colony ships here, full of people from every walk of life. I'd been the lady astronaut long enough to know how the game worked. From here on, I would be the lady astronaut of Mars. Epilogue.
First man on Mars addresses United Nations. Today, Dr. Leonard Flannery addressed the United Nations on the forthcoming second Mars expedition. Dr. Flannery will be heading the expedition to establish a colony on Mars. In his address, he urged all nations to work together peacefully to create a new home for humanity on our sister planet. This was not intended, he said, as a way to replace Earth, but rather to offer humanity new frontiers and opportunities. As a Negro, he was living proof that in space all men were created equal, and he hoped to serve as an inspiration to future generations. He was joined by his co-pilot, Dr. Elma York, who rose to fame in the early days of the space program as the Lady Astronaut. She wore a smart blue ensemble with a string of pearls at the neck.
I am landing on Mars today. The ester shudders around me as atmosphere brushes over the skin of our lander. In the navcomp seat behind me, Helen calls out our approach to Mars's surface. On my mark.
3:30 until ignition. Confirmed 3:30? My mouth is dry, but my hands are steady on the stick. The rest of the crew in the lander holds their tongues, but they have the same view I do, of the red surface spreading out to meet us. I pull my gaze away and watch the mission clock instead so I'll be ready when Helen calls it. Mark, 3:30. Confirmed. The digital numbers flick over in the countdown. To my left in the co-pilot seat, Leonard reads out the checklist the way he had for Rafael on his first trip.
Thrust translation 4 jets. Balance couple on. TCA throttle minimum. Throttle. Auto CDR. Propellant button reset. Prop button. Okay.
In response, I flick the appropriate switches. It's like landing on the moon, and it is nothing like that all at the same time. I am landing on Mars. The sequence of actions is familiar, but Mars's atmosphere changes everything. It is too thin to sustain life, but it could break us up in a second.
All right. Abort, abort stage reset. At control, 3 of them to mode control. AGS is reading 400 plus 1.
The remaining numbers bleed away from the countdown clock. Ignition. I squeeze the control, firing 4 of our jets. They kick, roaring into life. One of the colonists behind us yelps, I presume at the sound, since we've experienced the seat slamming into our backsides before. Gravity grinds me into my seat, and I tighten the muscles in my abdomen to keep blood in my head. Carefully, I yaw the ship over so the engines point down to the planet, and we begin our descent in earnest. Mars is hidden beneath us. Outside the viewport, plasma flicks past the glass. I keep my gaze split between the horizon and the altimeter. Throttling down? Leonard nods at my side.
1,500-meter altitude. 30.5 meters per second.
I start to do the math in my head, and then jerk my attention back to the controls. I have one job on this ship, and it isn't to do math. I am landing on Mars today.
914 at 21.3.
Behind us, Helen says, confirmed. You are go for landing. Which is good, because an abort would be hell on everyone at this stage, if I could even do it. I ease off the throttle more, dropping us lower toward the surface. At 305 meters, the glint of the Bradbury base's dome separates it from the rust of the landscape. I am actually on track, thank God. I keep the base centered on the grid of lines that were etched into the inside of the window. Horizon level, dropping speed, but not so fast that I don't land us off the mark.
229 meters, coming down at 7.6 meters per second.
A little fast yet. I ease out further, and below us the landscape takes on texture, with rough peaks and smooth sand dunes. The transmission tower at the Bradbury beckons, but the landing pad was hidden below dust. It had been too much to hope that it would stay clear. The landscape scrolls beneath us, and a dark shape runs over its contours. I grin, feeling like I'm seeing an old friend. We have a shadow?
30.5 meters, down 0.9, 3 forward.
Wetting my lips, I edge us ahead until we are over where the landing pad should be. At the bottom of the window, ochre dust swirls as if Mars is reaching up to say hello.
12.2 meters, down 0.73. Picking up some dust?
Leonard's voice is as steady as if he did this every day.
There's the pad.
Sure enough, the ship's exhaust had blown the dust away, leaving a beautiful flat square as ruddy as the rest of the landscape. I ease off the throttle and set us down. The feet of the lander bump and the G-forces shift. A light flashes on the dashboard, as if our status isn't clear.
Contact light.
Shut down. I pull my hand off the control stick and set it to neutral.
I also start to breathe again.
4 switches on the control panel later, I get to say 2 beautiful words. Engine stop. There is still a whole checklist to get through, but we are alive. We are on Mars. Behind me, the passengers let out a collective exclamation of glee. Nathaniel's voice carries clear through all of them.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu.
And he says he's a terrible Jew.
Grinning, I let myself have a full second of looking out the window at the dust blowing across the landscape under the smoky orange sky. And then duty calls. I toggle on my microphone and call the mothership. Goddard, Bradbury Base. The Estra has landed.
Congratulations, Bradbury.
Halim Malouf's voice has a giant grin built into it.
Perfect landing.
Thanks. It was. Happy to be down. My face hurts as I unbuckle my belt, because I am grinning like an idiot. Mars! I am on Mars! Leonard is already out of his seat and claps me on the shoulder.
Nicely done, Elba.
Thanks. I swivel out of my chair, awkward in my Mars suit. Helen leans forward in her seat, one hand still holding the belt buckle. Her mouth hangs open a little as she stares out the window. As I stand, she shakes her head, blinking back tears. Catching me looking at her, she shrugs sheepishly and pats her binder of calculations. I was looking down the whole way in. I bend over her chair and give her a hug. You've got time. Mission Control built in 15 minutes for gawking. 15 minutes for kissing. I still don't like that song, but it offers some good suggestions. I head to the back, where the colonists are getting out of their couches and running through their own checklists. Nathaniel looks up as I come down the aisle, helmet in his hands. His smile could power the entire planet. Granted, there are only 20 humans on it at the moment, but still.
Nice flying, Dr. York.
Why, thank you, Dr. York. Before you put that on, I rest one hand on his wrist to keep the helmet down and lean forward to kiss my husband. Honestly, I don't care that everyone on the planet is watching. We are not the only married couple on the ship, and I may have sparked a bit of smooching in other colonists. Helen and Renard are pretty adorable. I'm not sure that kissing is what Mission Control had in mind for this break, but they should have. At least they recognize that after traveling millions of kilometers to get here, we needed 15 minutes to be human. And then we all get back to work, like the professionals we are. In short order, we have the lander secured, luggage ready to offload, and all of our suits sealed and triple-checked. Leonard stands at the hatch and undogs it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Bradbury Base.
He swings the hatch open and a breeze pushes amber dust into the room. I wish I could smell it. Slipping my hand into Nathaniel's, I squeeze his glove. He leans over so his helmet rests against mine. With his mic off so only I can hear him, he says,
My suit is suddenly not fitting in a specific way. I may need your help later.
At that, the thermostatic controls on my suit appear to fail and heat floods it. I will do my best, as a scientist and your wife, to resolve that issue.
Elma?
Leonard waves me forward.
Want to do the honors?
Oh, my face is still red from Nathaniel's trouble. But you're the mission commander. He winks.
I've already been the first, and you are the lady astronaut of Mars.
Blinking against tears, which have enough weight to trickle down my cheeks, I duck through the hatch and balance on the top of the ladder. Mars! As far as the eye can see, the landscape rolls in dusty salmon, ochres, pinks, and flecks of deep purplish blue. 3 steps down the ladder, the fourth puts my right foot on Mars. My feet are standing on the surface of Mars. I am on Mars. I am on Mars. And there are other people waiting to also be on Mars. I shuffle away from the ladder to make space. Somehow a part of me had expected it to be like walking on the moon, but there's more gravity here. The dust kicks up in clouds held by the atmosphere instead of just arcing in a frictionless vacuum. As much as I want to stand and just stare, there is work to be done. There is work to be done on Mars. I head around to the side of the lander where the cargo bay is. Renard joins me, and we start the process of undogging the hatch. Nathaniel waves as he walks past, carrying a crate toward the Bradbury base, but that is all the time we have together for the rest of the afternoon. Space always sounds glamorous when I talk about it on television or the radio, but the truth is that we spend most of our time cleaning and doing maintenance. Today, we are doing that on Mars.
We are carrying crates on Mars. We are securing tie-down straps on Mars. We are waking a base that has been dormant for 4 years on Mars. The sun creeps over the horizon as we stow the last of the crates inside the small dome of the Bradbury. Nathaniel's team has blueprints and plans for expanding the base, but for now it is comfortably cozy for 20. Our first order of business will be to build the second habitat so that the colonists aboard the Goddard can come down to join us. My work has been about getting us to the surface of Mars. Tomorrow, Nathaniel's work begins in earnest. We have this one night where our careers are balanced against each other. I clamber into the Ester to make certain everything is locked down. She stands silent and empty around me. This is her first trip, but I'll be flying her up and down at least 5 more times to get everyone to the surface. I rest my hand on the pilot's seat with a sappy grin still on my face. Patting the seat as if I were saying goodnight to my aunt, I head toward the hatch. An astronaut is standing on the surface of Mars, waiting for me. The sun has vanished beneath the horizon, and I can't see his face, but I recognize Nathaniel's posture. Eager as I am, I take my time dogging the hatch in place, following procedure to the letter. 5 pumps of the handle to seat all 15 latches. Wait for the delta pressure gauge to indicate a good seat. Only then do I let myself down the 3 rungs and set foot on Mars again. On Mars. At some point, I will stop recognizing the wonder of where I am, but not today. I am on Mars. We are on Mars. Nathaniel holds out both hands. I take them, still grinning, and lean in as if I were going to kiss him, but just tap my helmet against his. I love you. Yes, we could use the suit radios, but then anyone who wanted could hear us.
I love you too.
His cheeks are streaked with tears.
Have you looked up yet?
No, I glance up and my words drop away. Stars. Above the undulating horizon of Mars, the night sky twinkles. The stars do not blaze in crystalline perfection the way they did in space. They sparkle through the atmosphere. Blue and red, silver and gold dance against a deep purple. Across that dancing backdrop, the blinking light of the Goddard traces an arc across the heavens. Oh, dear God, I hadn't seen the stars from the surface of a planet since March 3rd, 1952. Do you remember where you were when the stars came out? I was with my husband on Mars.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Faded Sky, Lady Astronaut, Book 2. Written and performed by Mary Robinette Kowal. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2018 by Mary Robinette Kowal. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.